Josh, episode 34 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. In this one, we will discuss Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm neither of those. I'm Jerry Shario. And it's my pleasure, as always, to introduce to you actor, director, composer, playwright, author of the annotated Abbott and Costello, a man who needs no introduction because he'll just show up anyway, Nick Santamaria.
Especially if there's free food. I'll be there. I'm a typical actor. I'm speaking from behind the couch because somebody said, today we want you to do Dr. Jekyll and Hyde. So I'm behind the couch and I'm hoping somebody finds me so we can get started with this thing. Jerry made me laugh today, which is not an unusual thing, especially visually. But Jerry sent me an email telling me that we're ready to go. You know, we're ready to start recording. And his way, the way he put it was, we're ready for Abbott and Costello's stuntmen meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde's stuntman. And I got to tell you, nothing was more accurate than that.
Oh,
and
yes.
We're going to be discussing that because this movie, it's an odd one. It's a real odd one. And it's odd in the sense that this is part of the oddness, is the fact that so many people that I know and respect think of this as one of their like two favorites. Like, wow. I'm serious. I mean, Rick Green, my friend Rick Green, in his book about Abbott and Costello, this was like his number one. You know, I think maybe Abbott and Costello, Frankenstein, and then this one. And if I'm wrong, you know, I'm sorry, but it's way up there. Mm-hmm. And not just him, but others as well. And I just don't get it.
Well, you know, there are people who think that Go West is a good Marx Brothers movie. So,
yeah,
you
and
never know.
There are mental institutions across the country of ours catering to people like that.
Yeah.
But speaking of which, I'm just going to throw this out. I told Jerry I've been watching a movie this morning. In my New York, you know, upbringing, we didn't get rural comedies like Ma and Pa Kettle movies or Judy Canova movies. I had no idea what a Judy Canova movie was. Then I saw one at CineCon a few years ago, Chatterbox, I think it was called. There's one she made with, she made a couple with Joey Brown, but this is one they showed. And I have to tell you, I laughed so hard, I almost fell out of my chair. No exaggeration. That's how funny it was. Well, this morning I found one on YouTube called Scatterbrain, and it's 1940, and it's so much funnier than Go West, than the Marx Brothers, the actual Marx Brothers. This is so much funnier. I'm laughing out loud watching this movie. It's a Hollywood spoof, and Judy plays someone from the mountains who mistakenly comes to Hollywood to become a big star, and you've got Alan Mowbray being just brilliantly funny, Eddie Foy being wonderful, Billy Gilbert, Charlie Hall has a great scene. It's just, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's on YouTube, and it's called Scatterbrain. Made in 1940. Anyway, so that's my plug for Scatterbrain. So let's get back to this cockamamie movie. As a child, I absolutely loved this movie. In fact, I can still recall when I was very young, it was still part of the CBS affiliate rotation before it went to Channel 11, Sunday mornings, you know, the regular rotation. So they would often play it at like 3 a.m. And I figured out very early on, when I was like in second grade, how to set my alarm, put it under my pillow, wake up in the middle of the night, and then turn on the TV very low, you know, very, very low, and watch the movies. And this is one of the ones that I would watch in the middle of the night. And I just loved it. And part of the reason I guess I loved it so much is because the sound was down so low that it played almost like a silent movie. Seriously, there are no real, I mean, there's a couple of jokes, but there are no wordplay routines between the boys. Really nothing dialogue-wise that you need to hear. Even the uncomfortable speech made by Karloff towards the end, you'd be better off not hearing it. So I was enjoying watching Lou, you know, do all his physical stuff and Bud getting hit over the head and all this stuff. It just played very nicely, silent. Then earlier in the week, I watched the Blu-ray with the commentary, and I forget who does it. Maybe it was Scott Allen Nolan or somebody. There were a couple of guys talking about the movie. Or no, it was one guy. So I wanted to play it with the commentary just to hear any facts that I might have not known and blah, blah, blah. And as I'm watching the film and listening to the commentary and not listening to the dialogue, I'm laughing out loud again. I'm looking at Lou running into walls, doing falls, even his stuntman, you know, doing crazy things. And it made me laugh. Then I watched it last night, full sound, you know, just this was my screening to make notes and all this stuff. And I didn't laugh. It's really interesting. I just, yep. There were a couple of times I guffawed, you know, mostly, again, Lou's physical stuff. But otherwise, it's just a strange movie.
Yeah.
You know, not their shining moment. So let's get down to it. Let's get down to, first of all, what we, I would like to ask you, Jerry, how you're doing.
I'm doing very well, sir. Thank you for asking.
You're so welcome.
As you have apparently taken great pleasure in pointing out, you know, I'm an empty nester.
You are. You're empty. You're empty nester, the Christmas donkey.
There we go.
There's the reference for you.
Wow. Can we talk about that movie instead of this one?
Well, what's the difference? Abbott and Costello, Rankin and Bass, you know.
Yeah, close enough.
Right? Porgy and Bass.
Yeah. Oh, but the funny thing to me, the funny thing is I have seen my son's girlfriend more than I have seen him in the past 3 weeks.
And that's a little kinky.
Yeah, well, you know.
You know?
Not nearly Sharon's as bad as Boris Karloff, but, you know.
That's pretty kinky. And I've heard about share and share alike, you know, but this is a little weird. But anyway, so good. So he's keeping his name alive through his his girlfriend.
Oh, yes.
So to speak. Okay. Well, that's good.
How about you?
I'm doing okay. I'm still healing from my head injury. And it's still very strange because it's still the top of my head just still doesn't feel like my own. It's just very strange. Ladies and gentlemen, I scalped myself a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And I literally, and I'm using it the proper way, scalped myself in a fall while I was sleeping. And when I went to the emergency room, the lady pulled my head down and sewed everything back together, 18 inches, that's a foot and a half. And it doesn't feel like the top of my head. She had to move everything in order to sew it up properly. And it's just very, very strange. But I'm alive and I'm lucky to be, and feeling good about it. So yeah, I'm doing fine, Jer.
Good.
Good.
Well, let's ruin that by talking about this movie.
Okay. It's the celluloid version of a head injury. We're really denigrating it already. We haven't even been there yet. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the people and the facts and figures. The movie is 76 minutes long. It was made for $725,000. It made $1,000,002. So the numbers were dropping a little bit. It wasn't, they didn't double their cost in this one. They went up about $500,000, which was nothing to sneeze at, of course. They were still moneymakers, but it wasn't like the old days, if you know what I mean. I do have some interesting money things, what they got paid for this movie. Bud and Lou, who were probably on the set half a day. I'm sorry, but those stuntmen were everywhere.
Oh yeah.
But Bud and Lou split $150,000. And I'm not sure if it was the 60-40 deal, but regardless, that's a lot of money. Boris Karloff, who was on the set for a quarter of a day, he was another one with that cockamamie mask on. You know, it was Eddie Parker. And he made, for the entire shoot, $15,000. So he made a tenth of what Bud and Lou made. Helen Westcott, who was the young lady, made $600 a week. And I think she only worked 3 weeks. So that's $1,800 she made. Craig Stevens made $750 a week. Reginald Denny, the wonderful Reginald Denny, made $1,000 for his 1 week of work. Very nice. His tall assistant, John Durkees, made $750 a week. And the stuntman who did the most work, well, let me put it this way. Eddie Parker, who did all the work for Boris Karloff in this movie, he made $300 a week. an 850 total. Vic Parks, who doubled for Lou, made the same, $300, but he worked more and he made $1,150. And that was it. So the people who did the most work made the least money. I will mention that Bobby Barber, who was the, you know, court jester, he made more money than the stuntman. He made $650 a week and he was there for the entire shoot. So he did pretty well. So those are the pretty much, that was the money stuff. And the writer, now it's credited to two people. First of all, the story is also credited to two people, but one of them is mostly fascinating. That's Sid Fields, who played Mr. Mm-hmm. Fields on the Abbott and Costello TV show. And he was writing for their radio show, and you know, he knew them in burlesque in the 1930s, and they were old pals. But he submitted a story treatment called Flowers at Midnight, where Bud and Lou play flower store owners. And it's weird. It doesn't really match what we have on the screen. So in order to get that together, they hired a writer by the name of Lee Loeb. Now, he was born in 1910 in New York City. I don't have much on him. It's hard to find information on Lee Loeb. But he did write for Columbia and Republic for a long period of time. He wrote lots of B movies, lots of television, but he also wrote on Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops, which is their next film, and also Meet the Mummy, which is their final film for Universal International. He was nominated for an Emmy for an episode of The Farmer's Daughter, starring the beautiful Inga Stevens. That's a show I used to watch when I was a kid. It was one mm-hmm. of those Saturday night lineup before the Hollywood Palace, which is what I was waiting for. But writer Lee Loeb put that together, not really known as a comedy writer, so duh. But his co-writer on this is John Grant. Now, Jerry, there may be two jokes that maybe I could, you know, credit to John Grant saying, hey, how about this joke? You know, why did he get a credit? Why did he get paid? There's none of his work here. There's really very little.
Usually the John Grant fingerprint is very easy to identify. But no, not here. And the two, my gosh, that's 50% more than I identified in the movie.
It's true. It's absolutely true. But anyway, so John Grant is involved, so to speak. Lee Loeb did most of the work. And it was released in 1953. All right. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the source material for this great character, Robert Louis Stevenson. Okay. And before I forget, I want to tell a quick story about when I was in fourth grade, I had to do an oral book report. I hated doing oral book reports, but my book was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. And of course I didn't read it. I read the crib notes on the back of the book, and I seen the movie 17 times with Wallace Beery and Jackie Cooper. But here's how I did myself in. I was in front of the thing, and I said, I recently read Treasure Island by Louisa May Alcott. For some reason, that three-tiered name came out of my mouth. My teacher, who had the weird name of Miss November, she was like a fold out, but she laughed so hard she ran into the next room across the hall to tell Mrs. Berger what I just did. She had to come and laugh at me. It was the most embarrassing thing I think that happened to me in grade school. But I had to explain away, and I got away with it, believe it or not. I said, oh, I'm so sorry, I meant Robert Louis Stevenson. And then everything calmed down, because I was able to tell them something about the story and all that. Yeah. So it pays to watch old movies when you're a little boy. So Robert Louis Stevenson, born in Scotland in 1850, I guess most famous for Treasure Island, Kidnapped, and of course the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was born with a bad bronchial condition. He spent his whole life traveling to different places in order to, you know, be able to breathe better. He ended up in Samoa. He loved Samoa. He wanted Samoa of Samoa. And so he moved there for a while, actually for the rest of his life. It's interesting to know that he also, along with Charles Dickens, he is tied for the 26th most translated author in the world. Wow. So how about that? Yeah, that's something. And he became an atheist early on. He left Christianity, which caused a great gaffe between him and his parents. He was a bohemian. He had long, unruly hair. He wore bohemian clothes. And strange case of Dr. Jekyll, 1886. He wrote it in Bournemouth, England. It's only 141 pages. It's a novella. And it's interesting that while he was writing it, he was very friendly. He became very friendly with the Reverend Walter Jekyll and his sister Gertrude Jekyll. Now, Walter was gay, and his duality might have inspired the plight of Dr. Jekyll. Hmm. He had quite a few gay friends, and he found that interesting, the duality that they had to live. They were forced to live because they would have been arrested otherwise. So anyway, I think that was very interesting, you know, to think about. Where did you get this from?
Yeah.
So his Jekyll in the novella, his evil desires prompt his wanting to change. So he has the evil desires while he's Dr. Jekyll. Actually, they say that this depiction, Karloff's depiction of Dr. Jekyll in this movie, is actually closer than either of the other movies, Frederick March and, you know, Spencer Tracy. Mm-hmm. It's actually closer to the novella than those characters were, because he was actually evil. He was not good Dr. Jekyll. He was someone who had evil cravings, and he had to meet them. This was known when it was released as a penny dreadful or a shilling shocker. In 1895, they did the first theatrical production starring the great Richard Mansfield, maybe the top actor of his day at that time. There were over 120 stage and screen productions of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, including a hit musical on Broadway in 1990. John Barrymore, of course, did the silent version and was wonderful, by the way. And then Stan Laurel did a really an hilarious version, a spoof of the Barrymore movie called Dr. Pickle and Mr. Pride. I would look for that on YouTube. It's very funny. And then, of course, Frederick March and eventually Spencer Tracy took a hand at it. And then there were many, many more after that. I will say that as the makeup department, Bud Westmore was in charge here for Universal, but his brother Wally actually created the makeup for Frederick March in 1931. And March won the Academy Award as Best Actor. He tied with Wallace Beery for The Champ. But Frederick March, in his thank you speech, credited Wally Westmore for the success of the character. Pretty cool. So there you go. We've got Robert Louis Stevenson. We've got the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Some people call him Dr. Jekyll.
Oh my gosh, that bugged me to no end in this movie. I mean, among everything else in this movie that bugged me, was the fact that different people would pronounce it different ways.
Right.
Yeah.
You had so many different, you know, you had British people in this movie, Australian people in this movie, American people in this movie. So yeah, they all had their own interpretation, their own way of doing things. And that was interesting. But anyway, the movie itself, there's lots to talk about. It begins, first of all, we recognize the music. We hear the music from Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. It's just the most perfect horror comedy score of all time. So why
it
not?
It really is.
You know, and it keeps popping up throughout the movie. You know, and it still works. So why not? So we have our opening, and that's a man, Dr. Poole. Now, in the novella, Poole is Dr. Jekyll's manservant and plays a very big part in it. But in this one, they mess around with the names. And he's Dr. Poole, a colleague of Dr. Jekyll's. But we see this I don't want to say hooded, he's got his cape in front of his face, like Bela Lugosi in Plan 9 from Outer Space, the chiropractor, has to keep the cape in front of his face. So he's hiding his face. He's hiding the horrific makeup mask that Bud Westmore created. And he's got his cane with him. And the guy stops to light a cigarette. And Mr. Hyde, or whoever it is, we're not supposed to know, kills him by hitting him with the cane. Now, as he's lighting a cigarette. And it just made me think that, yes, cigarettes are bad for you. You know, had he not stopped to smoke, he might still be alive today. But anyway,
he'd be old, but he'd be alive today. Yes.
Yes. Well, who knows? You know, you never know nowadays. 150 is the new 140. But so this is what got me is that he hits him with the cane. You can clearly see that he hits him on the brim of his hat. And the guy goes down and he strangles him for like half a second and the guy's dead. So I'm just assuming maybe it was his breath. I don't know. But it didn't play very well. But after he runs away and the guy is left laying there dead on the street, we cut to a fish and chips shop. Maybe we're still not aware from that opening shot of Big Ben that we're in London. By the way, that shot is also at the beginning of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and other Universal mm-hmm. horrors. Anyway, we see our leading man come out of the fish and chip shop. And I suppose he was reading the newspaper, you know, wrapped around the fish, and he knew about the killings. But he came out and he sees the guy on the floor and he looks at his card and he, you know, and we cut to the next scene. Well, the next scene is him actually sitting in a park on a bench reading the newspaper that, you know, Dr. Poole was killed and blah, blah, blah. And he looks over and there in the bushes are two legs of a man lying supine on the ground. And he thinks, oh my God, another body. But it turns out to be a sleeping man. And the sleeping man turns out to be Jimmy Aubrey. Interesting fellow. Born in 1887 in England. He was 2 years older than Charles Chaplin, but became one of his understudies when he joined the Fred Carnot Company in England. And as everyone knows, the Carnot Company was the comedy company to be a part of during those days. A lot of people call him the Lorne Michaels of his day. He would find the funniest people, hire them, and put them on. But anyway, Jimmy Aubrey went over to America with Carnot, and he eventually stayed. He actually became a star in silent comedies. He had his own series. I think he worked for Jess Robbins, but he had his own series of starring comedies, the Jimmy Aubrey comedies, and eventually settled into bit parts as talkies came in. And get this, Jerry, 419 film appearances, and that's what? Incomplete.
Wow.
Yeah, the guy did pretty well for himself.
Yeah. You
know? So that's Jimmy Aubrey, and he lived to a ripe old age. I think he was 95 when he died. Mm. So yeah, that was pretty cool. Pretty cool. So Jimmy Aubrey tells him, you know, that I'm not dead. I'm actually Jimmy Aubrey. And this starts a scene that I'm realizing, and I've been hearing from quite a few people about this. It's an interesting scene. Nobody likes it. Mm-hmm. This is the suffragette scene. Yep. And we meet Helen Westcott, our leading lady here. And the women are on a stage or in a gazebo in the park singing a song that basically says, we won't give you sex unless you give us the vote. And that's really what it is. We're not going to give you sex unless you give us the vote. Or whatever the hell it was. And in the meantime, while they're saying this, they're lifting their skirts and doing can-can dancing and all these sexy things while they're singing about they want respect and they want the vote. So it's really kind of an interesting thing there. But everybody gets into a fight. Okay, there's these four guys sitting on a park bench. And one of them is one of my favorite stuntmen of all time. That's Davy Sharp. Davy Sharp worked for years and he was wonderful. He was working like, you know, right into the Red Skelton show later on. But he was also one of the boyfriends from that great series, very unsung, from the Hal Roach people in the early 30s. And I think it was George Stevens who was the mastermind behind them. And they're very funny. Davy Sharp is one of them. Grady Sutton, Mary Kornman, Gertie Messenger. Really, really good people. But anyway, that's Davy Sharp. And now he was strictly a stuntman and he's on the bench and he even gets a line in this one. I forget what it is, but he has a line. So anyway, they start this huge fight in the park with the girls and yeah, let's put them back in the kitchen, you know, that kind of thing. And who shows up dressed as London Bobbies, but Bud and Lou, now named Slim and Tubby. Now I know that Lee Loeb, really, he worked 4 days trying to figure out these names for the boys. And he eventually came up with Slim and Tubby. Now, Lou was Tubby in Hit the Ice. So he actually had that name once before. And I find it unusual that he accepted it because he didn't like doing the names twice. And Bud was not exactly slim at this point. No. So, you know, you'd have to call them somewhat slim and the second time Tubby. I don't know. So anyway, so the boys come and they try to stop the thing and it becomes a big slapstick. You know, the girls beating the boys up, hitting them with their own truncheons. And at one point, Lou gets hit on the head so hard that he's knocked into a hole into the ground. It wasn't funny in 1940 when the Marx Brothers did it in Go West. It wasn't funny the 9,000 times they did it in the silent films. And it's not funny here. Eventually, I think Bud ends up in the hole eventually, and then the drum on his head. And it's just crazy, nutty slapstick. So what happens? They all end up in jail, even the boys. Somebody comes and bails all the ladies out, especially Helen. Now, I have to talk to you about Helen Westcott, because this is important. First of all, I want to mention my friend Kevin Butler reminded me today, and I'm going to mention that this movie, the role of Dr. Jekyll, was first offered to Basil Rathbone. Now, think of that. I think he would have been great. I really think he would have been great.
Yeah.
But he turned it down. He turned it down. And he never made a movie with the boys. That's a shame. He opted for Danny Kaye in the Court Jester. Mm-hmm. Boris took it once Basil turned it down. And we'll talk about Boris in a bit. Let's talk about Helen Westcott. She's the young lady, and she's very attractive leading lady in this. And she was born, she has the weirdest first name, Myrthas.
Whoa.
Myrthas. Now, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Mithras? No, that sounds like a Japanese monster. Mithras. It's a three-quarter Mithras. So that's her first name, Myrthas. That's it, Myrthas. Helen Hickman. So Helen was her middle name, Hickman, the last name. She was born in Los Angeles in 1928. She was the daughter of a singer by the name of Helen MacArthur and an actor at Warner Brothers. And he's one of my favorite pre-code sleazebags. Now, I say that because he always played a sleazebag. He always played someone you couldn't trust. Always a villain, always a sleazebag. I can't explain it any better. His name was Gordon Westcott. And he shows up in so many pre-code Warner Brothers. First of all, Warner Brothers is my favorite studio, and they made the best pre-code movies. And Gordon Westcott was a really large part of that family, that stock company. And whenever I see his name in the credits, I watch the movie. I just love him. So it was very interesting to find out that this was his daughter. Now, it was a sad story because, well, let me just name a couple of his credits. If you look for a movie called Heroes for Sale, in 1933, with Richard Barthelmess, who I like very much. He plays a guy who's in World War I in the foxhole with Richard Barthelmess. Richard Barthelmess does all this heroic stuff, and I think he gets wounded and disappears. And Gordon thinks he's dead and takes credit for all the heroics once he's back home. And he becomes like a celebrity. He gets a great job. You know, he just takes everything until Richard Barthelmess comes back. And then it becomes very interesting. He was also the sleazebag in Footlight Parade with James Cagney and Joan Blondell. He's the one that took all of James Cagney's ideas and took them to the competitors. He was in two Joey Brown movies, one I wasn't crazy about, Circus Clown, and then one I love called 6 Day Bike Rider, and he's the aggressor in that one. But he's also in a movie, it's one of the great lost movies of all time, called Convention City from 1933. It's supposed to be known as one of the naughtiest pre-code movies of all, and one of the movies that actually led to the code coming into effect the following year. So anyway, he's a part of that. Now, the sad part is when Helen was 7 years old, her father died in a polo accident. He was part of that group that played polo every Sunday. Walt Disney, Spencer Tracy, Samuel Goldwyn, a bunch of the really higher ups. And he was a part of this. And he was just about to celebrate his 32nd birthday. And he was gone. But at that same time, at 7 years old, Helen began a 9-year gig. Now, I don't know if you've heard about The Drunkard. The Drunkard was a melodrama that played in Hollywood in a small theater for years and years. And for 9 years, she played the young ingenue, first starting as the little kid and then, you know, of course, growing up. When she was 4, she started making her first films, small roles. She shows up in Midsummer Night's Dream in 1935 at Warner's, and she did a bunch of bit stuff and, you know, lots of Westerns and B-movies. And eventually, like in 1950, she's in The Gunfighter with Gregory Peck. She shows up in God's Little Acre in 1958. One of my favorite movies, The Last Hurrah with Spencer Tracy, 1958. She's also in 58. She goes from a movie like The Last Hurrah and God's Little Acre to Monster on the Campus, which I actually like better than both those movies. She had a long career, but unfortunately, she passed away in 1998 of cancer at the young age of 70. Mm. I like her in this movie. You know, she can't dance worth a dime. And I'm not sure. I'm not even sure if that's her voice. I'm guessing it is. If her mother was a singer and she'd been in the business since she was a baby, I'm guessing that might be her voice.
Yeah.
But anyway, she does a nice job. And so where am I as far as the movie is concerned? Right. Everybody's arrested. So Helen and Craig Stevens, our two lovers, are getting to know each other in prison. he's a newspaper man, and he's doing an interview with her about her suffragette business. And they're falling in love. You could see it. They're falling in love. So they're both bailed out, but Bud and Lou are left inside the jail. So here's an interesting story about the movie. Not really a story, but an interesting thing about Karloff and just what a prude he was. There's a scene where Craig Stevens and Helen Westcott are coming out of the police station, and Boris is waiting for them there. That's the first we really see of him. And he's Dr. Jekyll, the kindly, very famous Dr. Jekyll. And he bailed them out, and Craig Stevens, of course, thanks him and blah, blah, blah. So Boris Karloff says to Helen, who is his ward, he's been in charge of her since she was a little girl when she lost her parents. I mean, she checked her pockets and everything, then she lost and not in Alaska. So everybody can come back now. If you mention even part of the name of Lost in Alaska, people run away. The one good thing about that is I am realizing that it is my least favorite Abbott and Costello movie. More so than Africa Screams, more so than this one. But anyway, Karloff says, Helen, or whatever her name is, Vicky, I will drop you off at the theater where she works, wearing very little clothes. And she wants to be a suffragette. And then he was going to go home. Well, he said, can I drop you off somewhere, to Craig Stevens? And Craig Stevens takes full advantage. He jumps into the carriage. He sits right next to Vicky, puts his arm around her. And then Karloff has to get into the cab, and there's really no room for him. So he has to squeeze in on the end. Now, Karloff was very against doing this scene because he felt it was indecent. He felt like his close proximity to the two of them like that, crushed into that small space, was indecent.
Wow.
Now, that's a character thing. I mean, that's a real thing about Karloff. You have to, you know, and here's a guy who was married like 16 times, you know, in real life. He really was married a lot. And someone who marries so much can't be that perfect. You know, we have this image of Karloff as the gentleman monster. He's the gentle one. He's very kind and very nice to children and this and that. But he had his other side, just like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So in this scene in the cab, he does this speech. It's a close-up on him, and he's looking out into the distance as he, you know, speaks about goodwill and kindness to your fellow man. And I'm going to find the thing that makes people evil, and I'm going to get rid of it. It'll end wars. It'll end, you know, all contention. And, you know, I'm thinking about this. As he's saying all this stuff, none of it is true. He looks like he believes it. He's very sincere. But none of it is true. He's actually a vengeful, bitter creep who really is getting revenge on people. He's using his Mr. Hyde persona to get revenge on people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they drop Vicky off at the theater. And of course, Craig decides to get off with her. And now let me rephrase that, to get out of the cab. It was a dirty one. And of course, Karloff is, I thought you were going to meet a friend in my neighborhood. Well, I have a friend in this neighborhood too. So he goes with Vicky to the theater. Now let's cut back to Karloff, who is absolutely livid. We learn now that he has plans for Vicky. He's in love with Vicky, and he hates Craig Stevens. He obviously never watched Peter Gunn. So yeah, Peter Gunn is when Craig Stevens really became a star. Did I talk about Craig Stevens?
No, you have not.
Well, I'm going to right now because we're there.
Go right ahead.
Okay. He was born in Liberty, Missouri. How did he avoid an accent? I don't get it, because he was a big radio guy. He was born in 1918, and his real name, are you ready? Gale Schickles Jr. Now, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It could be Schickles or Schickles, or I don't know. It's S-H-I-K-L-E-S Jr. Gale Schickles Jr. He majored in theater at the University of Kansas, went to Hollywood in 1939, played very small roles, uncredited at most of the studios, until he was drafted into the Army, where he faced the dangers of working at the Hal Roach Studio in Culver City, making training films, actually just acting in them. That's what he did during the war. When he got out, by the way, before he went to war in 1941, he married the actress Alexis Smith. And they were married for 49 years.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Until her death. Okay, so he gets out of the Army. He's still playing supporting roles in films. He makes the best Bowery Boys movie, Blues Busters. He plays the, he wasn't really a villain. He's a competitor, but he's very good at it. And it is the best Bowery Boys movie you'll ever see. Satch develops a Bing Crosby-like singing voice. And it's very, very funny. He also shows up in lots of TV, a lot of B movies, including one of my favorites, The Deadly Mantis from 1957. He finally made a hit. He finally made a name for himself with Peter Gunn, the TV show by Blake Edwards, famous for that jazz score by Henry Mancini. It ran for 3 seasons, 2 at NBC and then the final one at ABC. It came to the big screen in 1967 via Blake Edwards' Gunn, G-U-N-N. So he was married to Alexis until 1993, and he passed away in 2000 from cancer. They didn't have any children. So that's our friend Craig Stevens, and he is our leading man in this, and he's solid. I think he's solid. He's not embarrassing. I think he's pretty solid in this movie.
Yeah, he is.
You know, he doesn't have anything to work with, but he does a nice job. So anyway, we see Karloff at home. And he goes into his hidden laboratory. There's a bookcase, of course, that opens, much like the one in Young Frankenstein.
Put the candle.
It's just like that one. And he goes in, and it's a downstairs, moody, you know, cellar, and there's animals in cages and things bubbling. And his assistant, Batley, is his name, and he starts battering Batley. He's very angry. He's like, yeah, I don't know. I think he was supposed to kill somebody and he didn't. No, he forgot to give one of the animals their injection and Karloff took it out on him, but he's actually very frustrated because he knows that his ward is falling in love with this reporter and he has to kill the reporter. John Dierkes plays his assistant Batley, and he's very formidable. He's very tall. He's about 6'6". And when the lighting is right, he looks very, very evil. And he's Dr. Jekyll's assistant. And he does a lot of the killing for him and also sweeps up. He went to Brown University. He was born in Cincinnati in 1905, by the way. He's a year older than Lou. He went to Brown University studying economics. He became an economist for the Department of State. He joined the Red Cross. I was going to say the Red Cross. He joined the Red Cross during World War II. It was there he met John Huston, who was very impressed by him and told him, come to Hollywood, I'll put you in the pictures. And he decided he was too shy. He didn't do it. So he took a job with the U.S. Treasury Department. And in 1948, while he was working for them, he was sent to Hollywood to be a technical advisor on the movie To the Ends of the Earth with Dick Powell. While he was there, Orson Welles created a friendship with him and cast him in his movie version of Macbeth, and then used him again much later on in Touch of Evil. But anyway, it started a whole thing for John. He appears in The Thing from Another World. He appears in Huston's The Red Badge of Courage, or it's just Red Badge of Courage. He's one of the three evil brothers in Shane. In 1953. He shows up in John Wayne's The Alamo in 1960. His last movie was called Rage, made in 1972. And more interesting, he actually appeared in, I believe it was 1958, Daughter of Dr. Jekyll. How about that? He died of emphysema at the age of 69 in 1975. Does a great job in this movie, by the way. He doesn't talk. He mumbles, you know? Mm-hmm. He's a Dick Tracy character. So we find out about Dr. Jekyll at this point and what he's really up to and what kind of a person he really is. But then we cut back to Reginald Denny, who is the police chief here in Scotland Yard. And he's the one who's regretting right now hiring those two Americans. He has to mention this, by the way, because we don't know why Bud and Lou are there in London. But they hired these two Americans, came over to learn the British methods of police work. That's what they came up with. So yes, and he regrets it very much because they're constantly causing trouble. So anyway, Reginald Denny, born in 1891 in Surrey, England. His real name, Reginald Lee Dugmore, D-U-G-M-O-R-E. He's the son of actor and opera singer W.H. Denny. He began in show business at the age of 7. And during that time, those 5 years, 7 to 12, he was on stage constantly. He eventually went to Mayfield College in Sussex, ran away from there when he was 16. He trained as a boxer. He wanted to learn how to box, and it came in handy later because he made a few films, silent films, called The Leather Pushers, and it was all about boxing, him being in the ring. He went back to acting, appeared in England in the production of Merry Widow. He worked all over the world doing stock, and he got into films in 1911, but it really wasn't until 1915 that he was in it in earnest. He did Barrymore's Richard III on stage with John Barrymore, and they became very friendly. Later, he did Sherlock Holmes with John Barrymore in 1922 in the movie. Much later, he did with John Barrymore Romeo and Juliet at MGM in 1936. And he did a bunch of Bulldog Drummond movies in that series for Paramount between 1937 and 1938. So they worked together quite a bit and were quite friendly. He was well known in silent films, Reginald Denny. He had his own series of comedies, comedy shorts. And he was very funny. Kino, the video company, the DVD company, Kino Lorber, actually did restorations of his films and released them on Blu-ray. So if you want to check out Reginald Denny and his work, it's all there. Now, to me, other than his many, many films, and I'm a big fan, I'm a big Reginald Denny fan, he was an aviator. In World War I, he got into the Royal Air Force and really took to it. He became an aviator, and he was fascinated with the motor of the plane. So he developed model airplanes that flew on their own by remote control, by radio control. And he opened a model plane shop in 1937. It became a chain store, Reginald Denny's Hobby Shop. And the first one opened on Hollywood Boulevard in 1937. And it was very, very popular. And he made a fortune doing this. Mm. In 1939, he developed the actual radio-controlled airplanes for war use and got the very first war contract. So he started developing that in his own factory. And in the meantime, he's doing these great roles in movies. He's always good. Always. Mm-hmm. I especially love him in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. He's the architect, and he's very funny. He's so good in so many things. And he gains points for me because his last film was as Commodore Schmidlab in the Batman movie in 1966, and he's
terrific. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Unfortunately, he passed away the very next year in 1967 of a stroke. Mm. But anyway, we love Reginald Denny, and he's very funny in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
So he tears the boys new ones and actually fires them. It's a very weird scene, and I'm going to mention it because he turns around to Lou and he takes off his shoulder epaulets that says he's a cop. He takes away the things on his collar and he's fired. Right. And so he does it to Bud. Bud, of course, tries to throw Lou under the truck. Well, we have to get rid of people like that, Captain, because, he's no good. And of course, the captain starts ripping off, Bud's stuff, to much to his amusement. And then Lou just starts pulling off Bud's buttons, one at a time. Boom, boom, boom. It's not funny, but it just fades out there like it's supposed to be funny.
If I may point out right now.
Please do.
We are talking about Bud and Lou for only the second time, and we're approaching an hour into this podcast. That says a lot about this movie, as far as I'm concerned.
You're absolutely correct, because one of the things I wanted to bring up about this movie is that it's basically a B-level universal horror movie from that era. Played straight, of course, and which is great because it should be played straight. But I'm saying that it's a standalone movie with Bud and Lou. It reminds me of Laurel and Hardy in A Haunting We Will Go, which is my least favorite Laurel and Hardy movie. It's a standard mystery that you would see in a Charlie Chan movie or any other series. And Laurel and Hardy just happened to be in it. They're not especially hilarious or anything, but they happen to be in it. That's what this one is like.
Mm-hmm.
And, and of course, they're Abbott and Costello. They do typical physical Abbott and Costello stuff, but they really don't do what they're famous for. Again, as the movies progressed more towards situations, they lose the crosstalk.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't mind them losing the crosstalk because they do it all the time. And here's why. I'm going to tell you why. I think it was really Lou that insisted on this journey towards situational comedy. At that time, 1953, the boys had 7 movies showing to the public. Universal re-released 4 of them. There were 3 new ones, including Lost in Alaska, Go to Mars, and now Jekyll and Hyde. So 7 movies are out there. And in them, so they're doing some of the routines and blah, blah, blah. So you can't repeat them so soon, And then, of course, they did 4 appearances already on the Colgate Comedy Hour. They premiered their TV show, was a syndicated show was running. So they were everywhere. You couldn't look in any direction without seeing something from them. And this is how Universal killed them. This is how they killed them off early. It was just overexposure. So anyway, they couldn't do those routines over and over again. They were repeating them on the TV show. They were repeating them on Colgate.
Yeah.
So that's why this one is basically just a lot of running around and falling down and, a lot of physical shtick. So anyway, the boys are fired. And here we go again. Karloff decides to change into Mr. Hyde, which he does. And I believe Karloff did the actual transition for this one, because Lou only did enough where he was recognizable. Then it became his double, Vic Parks. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have to sit through the whole hours long transition. But it looks like Karloff did it, But the funny thing is, once he did transform, it wasn't him anymore. Mm-hmm. It became stuntman Eddie Parker, one of the best stuntmen in the business, born in Waukegan, Illinois. 6 years after Jack Benny did in 1900. I don't have much on him. It's hard to find real facts on him, but he really was one of the great stuntmen of all time. He was also in Monster on the Campus. He played the monster, of course. He's in many Universal horror films, including Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman and many more. And of course, he shows up in the boys' very last film for Universal International, Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, where he actually plays the mummy in a costume that I don't think I would wear to a Halloween party. But it really didn't matter with that movie because the movie was really strong. So you could overlook that. So there he was. He died very young. He was only 59 years old. He died in 1960 of a heart attack. And I'm not surprised because this guy did some stuff that, wow, you can't believe it. He's buried in the same cemetery that Lou is, and that's the Calvary Cemetery in downtown Los Angeles. So anyway, that's Eddie Parker, and he sets out to the music hall where he's going to kill the reporter, Craig Stevens. He hates him, and he says it several times.
I hate him. I hate him.
A lot of hate in this movie. So in the meantime, Bud and Lou, in their civilian clothes, are really bent on getting back on the police force. So they want to go catch the monster. Now, this is very unusual for Abbott and Costello. They're kind of brave in this one. They're looking to confront the monster and catch him. Now, in every other movie, they would run in the other direction. But they really are, you know, their nose to the grindstone. We got to catch this guy. So they do something to get into the theater, which is, turns out to be maybe one of my two favorite things in the movie. Of course, there's the doorman who won't let them in. So Bud tells them that they are the new dance act. And he goes, show them, Tubby. And Tubby does this 30-second ad-libbed tap dance that is so adorable and so funny. I mean, it's really nothing. It's great. It really is great.
Yep.
But what gets me about it, and I complain about this in other shows, other podcasts, but Bud, when Lou finishes the dance, he grabs Bud's arm and the two of them go out together. Now, Lou is doing a little dance step, a very easy one. Bud isn't. Mm-hmm. Why didn't Bud learn that little step? Think about how charming that would have been, just how much of a team they would have been. You know, it's just... They missed out on those opportunities, and I think it really had to do with Bud's laziness, really. He didn't care about that stuff, you know? He did what he was paid to do, and that was play straight to Lou. Unfortunately, his strength was disappearing at this point because they weren't doing what he was strong at, what he was strongest at, and that was the crosstalk routines. All right, so they're all at the theater. This is all shot on stage, Universal Stage 28, the Phantom of the Opera stage, the most famous stage in Hollywood, which was just torn down recently. I think it was about a year ago or two years ago, something like that. But it's gone, just like most of the great stuff in Los Angeles. It's just going away. So in the theater, Bud and Lou have to check the dressing rooms. Lou, of course, looks into the ladies' dressing room first. We hear a scream. So original. And so they start, looking around, and this is one of my favorite things, and this made me laugh when I couldn't hear the soundtrack and it was like silent. When Lou runs into the Chinese dancer who has the big grotesque mask on, and he turns around and he first sees it and he does a take that is so funny. It's hard to explain. It really is. Yeah. But if you go back and you see him encounter backstage this guy, just watch Lou's take. It's funny times 10. But anyway, they're looking around. And I have to say, the lady Chinese dancer in the show, they're actually showing part of the show. Helen Westcott does a dance number, sort of, with the chorus girls, and does a one line from a song. It's very strange. It's like they cut the song. But she does it in one of the worst Cockney accents I've ever heard. Almost as bad as Waiting for Guffman, you know. Hello. Oh. But anyway, so they do that. And the woman in the Chinese dance was the wife of Jeffrey Holder on the Uncola Nut. Remember him from the 7-Up commercials? That was his wife. I just a little trivia I'd throw out there. That was my nickname in high school, by the way, little trivia. There's a nice shot when, I have to say, it's a little scary too, when Craig Stevens and Vicky are kissing for the first time in her dressing room. And they move away, and you see Mr. Hyde in the window. And there's fog coming up, and it's just him watching. And you know he's ready to kill him. And it's creepy. It's really kind of nice. Great photography, by the way. I think it's George Robinson. So anyway, he comes into the theater, and Bud and Lou, who are outside looking for the monster, Lou looks up and sees Mr. Hyde climbing up the side, you know, a pipe on the side of the building to get into the theater. And they think it's a burglar. And Lou says, come on, let's catch the burglar, and then we can get back on the force, and then we can look for the monster, and blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to shoot ahead here. They go into the theater. It's all kinds of, you know, misinterpreting who's who. Bud gets hit on the head with a chair by accident. And he's very funny, by the way, with his hat over his head and his ears and the way he looks like, you know, he's out of it. Bud can be very funny physically.
Oh, yeah.
It's very funny. But then when he gets hit again, I really love Lou's response. Lou puts his arms around, oh, Slim. You know, it's not typical. It's very, very nice. So this leads to Bud, this is another one of my favorite parts. Bud goes up to who he thinks is the Chinese dancer with the big mask on, but it's actually Mr. Hyde hiding. Bud says, by the way, did you see a monster around here? And instead of saying no, it's, and Bud just says, oh, okay, I'll keep looking, and leaves the room. But the interesting thing about this is in every other version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Mr. Hyde speaks. He's not a monster. I mean, he's a monster the way he acts, but he speaks. He's a person. In this, he just growls. He's a monster. He's an animal. Very strange. Anyway, so they're looking for Mr. Hyde, and this eventually goes to the first rooftop chase. It's nothing special. You know, the stuntmen are running around. Is this where Lou does the clothesline? He's jumping over between buildings, and he falls, and he ends up in the Long Johns hanging on a on a clothesline over this incredible abyss. You would think they were on top of the Empire State Building. And so, interestingly, there were two injuries reported during the making of this movie. One of them was Eddie Parker himself, and I just described them jumping between buildings from one building ledge to the next. He actually sprained or broke, whatever it is, his ankle at that point. I think he sprained it. And then it was reported that Lou tore a ligament doing that scene with the Long Johns and the clothesline. Huh. It turns out, even though there is a still of Lou inside the Long Johns, being, you know, set up, it's not used. Vic Parks does everything. Vic Parks, Lou's stuntman, is the one hanging in the thing. So where did Lou, you know, hurt his ligament? I don't get it. Anyway, it's probably publicity. So anyway, they're doing the rooftop thing. Is this where the Wax Museum comes in?
Yes.
Lou decides to take a shortcut going downstairs from the roof. And he ends up falling actually into a wax museum. And as he's falling, he grabs these wires ahead of him, and they're all electric, you know, that you can see the sparks and everything. But, you know, they're hanging down as he falls into the wax museum. Now in the wax museum are effigies of, did I just say that? are wax figures of the Frankenstein monster, Count Dracula, and several other people, George Washington, you know, historical people. But anyway, this may be my favorite scene in the movie. And that's because it really gets to be a lot of fun. When Lou encounters Mr. Hyde, he does a take that is so funny. Actually, it's when he sees Mr. Hyde, he runs over to who he thinks is a policeman, and says, come on, we've got to arrest him. And he grabs his hand and pulls it. And of course, it's a dummy. And the whole arm comes off in his hand. And when he sees it, he does a very funny take. And again, that's what this movie boils down to. He does a funny take. It's a physical thing. There's nothing, you know, verbal. They do add jokes like,
I got to go home. I forgot something. What did you forget?
I forgot to stay there.
No, you don't. Come on.
That's one of the things John Grant may have woken up to say, hey, do this one. but there is some funny dialogue when Craig Stevens is telling the boys what to do when they're on the roof. He says, okay, now Slim, you go that way. I'll go this way. And Tubby, do you know which way to go? And he goes, home. The timing is better than the joke, actually. But it did get, I got a laugh out of me. Okay, so he's in the wax museum. and he sees Mr. Hyde. Everything goes crazy. He backs up against a thing where the head comes off, and he looks at the head and he gets scared and he throws it away, and it lands on a cat. And of course, the head starts moving across the room and scares Lou even more. He runs over. He gets tangled up in the electrical wires, which get tangled up with the Frankenstein monster who comes to life and starts coming after Lou. And of course, you know, this is so reminiscent of a much better movie. I'm wondering if Eddie Parker sprained his ankle. Maybe Lon Chaney Jr. would have dressed up as the monster. No, wait, that's a different movie. So anyway, the monster's coming after Lou, and you see the sparks are flying and all this. So here's what happens. Lou is very cagey, you might say. He runs into a cage, an actual cage. Mr. Hyde follows him in. Lou runs out and locks him in. So, of course, now he goes over and he's got to get everybody. I caught him. I caught the monster. And, of course, by the time they all get there, he is turned back into Dr. Jekyll. All right. So this is when Dr. Jekyll makes a report. These idiots, you know, look what they did. I was walking by and I heard some noise and I came in. It was some, you know, some bull. And he knows that Lou saw him, and he knows that Lou saw the ring he wears. So he's got to get rid of Lou now. So he invites the boys to walk him home as protection. Okay. So, by the way, before this happens, again, I'm sorry to jump around like this, but these are things that I remember. And to be honest with you, I get a lot of comments about things that I forget to mention. They're there in my notes, but I just can't mention everything because it'll be like 3 hours. But I do my best. I honestly do. But anyway, I was saying that Bud and Lou, when he asked them to walk him home, Lou doesn't want to go because he knows he's the monster. I saw what I saw when I saw it. And Bud tells him, and this I find so interesting, Bud tells him, don't you realize what it is, what it means that an important man like Mr. Jekyll invites us to walk him home? Mr. Jekyll? I don't think anyone ever referred to him as Mr. Jekyll in any of the incarnations of this story. But Bud Abbott, and a good friend of mine said, well, at least he didn't call him neighbor. his neighbor asked him to walk us home. So anyway, they walk him home. They are invited to stay the night for further protection. Bud goes to sleep. Lou walks around the house, is being followed by John Dierkes, who wants to kill him. But it doesn't happen, of course. Another thing I wanted to mention, okay, in Bud's favor, when he hears Lou screaming, you know, help, help, from the wax museum, Bud actually tells the cops to go get help while he breaks down the door. He actually breaks down the door to get to Tubby. And it's great. And you know what I mean? That's the Bud I love. You know, he actually sacrifices himself to go help his friend. And then once he's inside, you stay here. I'm going to go get some more help. So he leaves him with the monster. So just when we think Bud is turning over a new leaf, we realize it's only a small pebble that he's turning over. And by the way, when they first arrive at the doctor's home, and this is after Bud and Lou actually find the laboratory, the hidden laboratory with the animals, and there's a rabbit that barks like a dog that meows like a cat, and most impressively, a monkey that moves like a cow. Mm-hmm. Talk about monkey milk. I want some monkey milk. So yeah, he's got all these things and it's freaking Lou out. And Lou, during at one point, he drinks this drink that's on top of the water cooler, one that the doctor absentmindedly left behind. And he's feeling funny, you know, but Bud and Lou decide to go and leave because they're a little afraid now. And Lou turns into a mouse. Now, I'm going to amend that because it's actually Vic Parks that turns into a mouse. Lou does the first few shots, and then it becomes Vic Parks' face. Now, my thing about Vic Parks, he looks enough like Lou. In the long shots, it's very difficult to tell the difference visually. Mm-hmm. It's the way he moves that gives it away.
Yeah.
Lou's voiceovers, you know, that he obviously recorded, it's almost like he wasn't watching the footage as he was recording it. You know, and Vic Parks he tries to run funny. He tries to walk funny. You know, Lou didn't do that. I don't know. It just, it's weird. It's really strange. And even as a kid, I knew that's not Lou. Also, Eddie Parker as Mr. Hyde, you know, he does all the work. And there's a point in the movie where Boris Karloff, as Dr. Jekyll, is walking away from the camera. We see him from behind. Now, we all know that Boris Karloff was terribly bow-legged, and he's wearing especially baggy pants, so you can't tell. But you can tell from this shot behind, you know. But you don't see that when Eddie Parker's working. Eddie Parker's slim. He's athletic. He makes moves that the 66-year-old Karloff would never be able to make. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's another rooftop chase where they do this interminable thing around the square. There's a square thing. What do you call that on the roof?
Yeah, it's almost like a shed. Or yeah. some structure on the rooftop that's on just a square.
It's completely square. And four of them. Lou, okay. I left out the part that I wanted to talk about most. And we're going to go back and talk about it now.
You go right ahead.
Okay. What happens is Craig and Vicky, along with Bud and Lou, come to look at the lab. Because Bud and Lou tell them that they think Dr. Jekyll's the monster. They turned Lou into a mouse and blah, blah, blah. There's the whole business with the Mauselle, you know, the wine. Mm-hmm. He gets Lou drunk, which is very sweet, by the way. He's a good drunk. He never did that in a movie before. Mm-hmm. And it really works. He's very good. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they go to a bar and Lou is still the mouse. He's actually Vic Parks. And Clyde Cook is there. He's one of the drunks who sees him. Clyde Cook was a star comedian in The Silence. Even Hal Roach tried to make him a star in the early 30s. But anyway, he was playing bit parts by this time, just like Jimmy Aubrey. But anyway, so we're back looking at Karloff's laboratory. He has to prove that there's, you know, nothing there. And sure enough, they all go down to the laboratory, and it's not a laboratory anymore. It's a wine cellar. So they changed everything around. They're all pointing fingers at Bud and Lou. You idiots. Don't you realize what you're doing? Blah, blah, blah. So when Craig Stevens and Vicky, Helen Westcott, are there alone with Boris Karloff as Dr. Jekyll, they tell them that they'd like to get married. If we could have your approval, we'd love to get married. Now, Karloff is holding a glass of wine at this point, and the glass breaks in his hand, of course, when he hears this. And that shows us how angry he is. But anyway, he of course plays it up. Oh, of course, we'll have the biggest wedding in the world, and we'll invite Elon Musk and all of that. So yeah, he's pretending that he's very happy. Craig thanks him. And as Craig leaves the house, he stops to light a cigarette and he's, you know, sort of lingering a little bit. And in the meantime, Karloff brings Helen into the study and she says, oh, thank you so much for taking it so well and blah, blah, blah. And he just lays into her and he finally says what he means. Don't you realize that you're the person I'm going to marry? You're not going to marry anyone else but me. I've loved you since you were a little girl. And that's where it stops. That's where I'm like, okay. I'm picturing her watching, you know, her play with her dolls, and he's like licking his lips and, you know, I'm going to marry that child. So very, very weird, very uncomfortable, just uncomfortable. I'm sorry. I can't believe it was in the movie. So anyway, she discovers that he is the monster. She screams. Craig Stevens hears her, runs into the house. He's about to escape with her out the window. But when he sees two cops outside waiting, he decides to change his mind. And he starts leaving and he sees Craig Stevens and he turns around and runs away. He runs away? Why didn't he jump on Craig Stevens, you know, and strangle him in half a second like he did at the beginning of the movie? Instead, he runs out the window and he decides to climb up to the next floor and he falls and dies. That's it. That was it. He just falls and dies. And then there's the reverse transition. When he's dead on the floor, he turns back into Boris Karloff. And you can see very, very briefly on his chest his check for $15,000. All right, so we're done with Dr. Jekyll. He's gone. Craig and Helen have a happy future ahead. And Bud and Lou, since during the fight in Karloff's office, I forgot to mention, he had a needle, and his plan was to make Craig Stevens a monster, kill him, and then say he was defending his ward, Helen. That's his big plan. She knocks it out of his hand. It lands on a couch. And of course, Lou is pushed onto the needle. And it's really horrifying to watch because it goes right into his butt. And you see it. I mean, it's like lovingly shot. Mm-hmm. And then during the fight, Mr. Hyde, after he turns into Mr. Hyde, he starts choking Lou and he's pushing him up and down on the needle like 175 times. I mean, it's horrifying. He just keeps poking him and poking him and poking him. So eventually, of course, Lou turns into a monster. He turns into a Mr. Hyde, and the two of them are loose. You know, and I got ahead of myself with Dr. Jekyll dying. But anyway, it's very funny because Reginald Denny is in the Scotland Yard office and he keeps getting calls saying, "We see the monster in the East End." And he puts a pin on the map. And then someone calls and they see the monster completely on the other side of London, you know, because there's two of them. So he doesn't know what to do. And he's putting in pins and it's very frustrating. My favorite part of this is when Lou is driving as Mr. Hyde, he's driving the paddy wagon. He jumps onto the paddy wagon. The guy jumps off and he's got a paddy wagon full of police and he's driving down the streets, you know, and when they see him and they yell at him, he jumps off and he lands on a tandem bicycle in the middle seat between two people. And of course he turns around to the guy is like, "Hey, get off the bicycle," you know, in the terrible English. And, the guy sees him and jumps off. So it's just the lady in front with Lou as Mr. Hyde in the back. And of course, she sees him eventually and she jumps off the bicycle. And I have to say, I've never seen a worse stunt lady in my life. She's a middle-aged woman on the bicycle. You know, you can see the wrinkles and all that. She jumps off and then she's suddenly 20 years old and very, very attractive. And she's and she runs off. It's like, well, maybe all women should fall off a bicycle. Well, anyway, getting back to it, Lou is captured by Bud. He's knocked out when he hits his neck on a clothesline on the roof. They tie him up, and Bud, with some police, brings him to Reginald Denny. He said, "Well, I caught the monster. I should get a promotion, blah, blah, blah." And in the meantime, Lou changes back to Lou. They don't see this, but, you know, Bud's ready to get his job back and his bobby hat and all that. And they turn around, and they see it's Lou. And they all, you know, as they were approaching Lou or bringing him in, he bit four different policemen. And you see them, they're all holding their hands, it really hurts. And then Reginald Denny comes up and points his finger in his face and he bites Reginald Denny, okay? So Bud, of course, in a two shot, the two of them, he admonishes Lou. "What are you doing? I had the monster here. Why are you dressing up as the monster? What is this, a joke?" And they turn around and you hear this growling. And there is a really creepy shot. And it is creepy. It's almost scary. Mm-hmm. Of all four policemen and Reginald Denny as monsters. It's all done in low light in a really strange up angle, and it really works. And then you cut to Abbott and Costello, who in fast motion, under cranked, run out of the office through a glass partition and out the door. And that's the end. And it's really a good ending to a bad movie.
Are you sure it's a good ending, or are you just happy that it is the ending?
There's a little of both there. Yeah. But even from childhood, I've always loved that ending. It's uh-huh. I find it very clever. Okay, so here's the addendum to this entire thing, and then we will let you go. I know this has been long. Thank you for sticking with us, those of you who did. But anyway, the film was released in August, in summer of 1953. They had wrapped the film in February of 1953. Now, on February 13th, it was a historic day because Boris Karloff shot his last horror scene in a Universal movie in 1953 on this shoot. That was his last. Starring in Frankenstein in 1931. So here it was 22 years later doing his final shot at Universal. Okay, so they wrapped the movie in February 1953. They did not start their next film, Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops, until June of 1954. Wow. Almost a year and a half later. Why did that happen? Okay, here's the deal. In 1953, Lou was going to make a political appearance alongside Joseph McCarthy, believe it or not. Not one of Lou's better decisions. Yeah. But anyway, he was going to appear with him because he was an anti-communist and blah, blah, blah. And before he got on the plane, he collapsed from exhaustion, which of course led to his rheumatic fever. And he was off his feet for another long period of time. In the meantime, Universal had already had their next movie ready. It was called Fireman Save My Child, another lousy script. Mm-hmm. A lot of people thought Lou pretended to be sick just to get out of it. But so Universal had to decide, since they had already shot long shots with their stuntmen, and of course one was slim and one was tubby, they could scrap what they've done and just, you know, scrap the whole thing. Or they could have hired two people who actually looked like Bud and Lou to actually finish the movie. And they would beef up the roles of Spike Jones and his City Slickers, who were the musical guests in the movie. So that's the best thing about the movie, was the numbers by Spike Jones.
Oh, yeah.
So they hired Hugh O'Brien to play the Abbott role. Hugh O'Brien?
Yes, and that comedic genius, Hugh
that
O'Brien.
Genius.
Yes.
Oh, God, we all look up to him because he was tall. And then they hired a person who absolutely insulted the memory of Lou Costello, Buddy Hackett, who at the time was the right age for playing Lou Costello in that later horrible movie made in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Bud and Lou, horrible, horrible film.
Yep.
But anyway, and Buddy Hackett was just terrible in it. But he's terrible in this too. These are the guys they hired. Buddy Hackett doesn't get one laugh. He's just awful. They were hoping that this was going to be a film that would push him forward, and it did. It pushed him right out of Hollywood. he went back to nightclubs at this point. He made a few other movies, of course, you know, along the way, best of which is It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened. They ended up filming the movie with these people, with this cast, and Bud and Lou dodged a bullet thanks to Lou's ill health.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, you know, he came back, he came around. This was also the time that Bud did the only Colgate Comedy Hour show where Lou was not a part of it. Bud hosted it on his own. You could find that either online on YouTube or in the great Blu-ray, Abbott and Costello Rarities, that also has it. But Bud is a very congenial host. He's very good.
Yes.
Very, very comfortable. And this was his first time alone in like 20 years, you know, without Lou. But their buddies, Martin and Lewis, actually helped to bring up the slack and did some wonderful stuff towards the end. Yeah. And there's one scene or one point where Bud is on one side, Jerry's in the middle, and Dean's on the other side. And Jerry just said, "I must be a great comedian. I've got two straight men." So only he did it sounding more like Jerry Lewis, but they showed a couple of the better sketches from Abbott and Costello instead of, you know, Lou being there. Mm-hmm. So that's something to look out for. So there we are. That's the story. That's the entire story. I hope you enjoyed this. In fact, I hope you enjoyed it more than the movie. But in a way, I hope you enjoyed the movie too. I never want anyone to dislike one of these movies. And I don't dislike any of them. In fact, I don't dislike this movie. I don't think there's one Abbott and Costello movie where there isn't at least one or two things that make my day. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they're really not bad. This one just happens to be, and Matthew Conium says it in his chapter in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. He says that you have to have a least favorite of everything. And this is my least favorite. So I have to go along with that. I think this is my least favorite of their films. Okay, so we are up next for episode number 35, coming soon. But first I want to ask, as I do every time we do this, your assessment, Mr. Shario, on this film.
My assessment is I felt like we were back in time in Buck Privates, in that you had this movie going on and occasionally Bud and Lou showed up and did something.
Right.
And then the other thing that really stuck out to me, especially after, you know, last episode, we were talking about Go to Mars and how the romance, the relationship there was practically non-existent.
Yeah.
And I think they were trying to make up for it in this one, in the fact that, you know, Bruce and Vicky meet and are engaged within, you know, 36 hours.
Right. It was only a 76-minute movie.
Yeah, they had to move fast. Yeah. But yeah, but I agree. I actually enjoyed the sets, the rooftop chases, just for the sets themselves, the detail that they put into those.
Yeah, I think the film looks great.
Yeah.
No complaints about that.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you on that final shot. Those five Mr. Hydes of sort were very scary.
It was scary. And Bud Westmore said they actually had to mold 9 different masks for the shoot. Wow. So there wasn't just that one. Yeah. It also shows up, I think it's the same mask because it looks almost exactly the same. There's a movie, a great, I call it great. It's one of my favorites from childhood. It's called The Neanderthal Man. And he becomes a Neanderthal man, and it looks like this mask. And I believe the Neanderthal man was, what's his name, from Robert Shane from Superman. I could be wrong, but I think it was him. Anyway, so that's that. Bud and Lou are coming back in a very interesting film called Abbott and Costello Meet the Keystone Cops. I like it actually a lot more than this one.
Oh, yes. And,
yeah, you too, Jer?
Yes, most definitely.
Yeah, and that theme song will stay in your head probably for the rest of your life.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So let's meet up in 2 weeks, Mr. Shario, and we will continue on as we really wrap up their Universal film career.
Yeah, my gosh. We're already there.
Isn't that strange? Oh, boy. Wow. This was just an idea, you know, that became this crazy thing. Kind of like television or the George Foreman sandwich maker or whatever the hell it is. Okay, gang, take good care of yourselves and we will see you soon, or you will hear us soon. Jerry, take care of yourself, pal.
And you too, my friend.
Take care, all.